You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 27th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, senior editor at Mother Jones Magazine, Michael Mechanic, on Jackpot, how the super rich really live, how their wealth harms us all. Meanwhile, U.S. pledges to share 60 million vaccine doses with the world. Joe Biden signs an executive order raising federal contractors' minimum wage to $15 an hour. Census releases its data. Rust Belt takes the biggest hit on congressional seats. But New York lost one seat. By 89 people out of the 20 million in this state. Cuomo's failure to take the census seriously is blamed. California recall effort hits its threshold. Gavin Newsom will face, amongst others, challenge from Caitlyn Jenner and Mike Cernovich. DOJ to investigate the Kentucky Police Department in the wake of the Breonna Taylor killing. That brings to two the number of police departments under active investigation by the Department of Justice. Earmarks return to the Senate spending bills as Joe Manchin seems to foreclose just about everything. Biden administration under pressure is now reconsidering returning to the 65,000 refugee cap. Maybe a little more pressure. Maybe they'll consider double that or triple that. Lastly, DHS to undergo an internal review of white supremacists in its ranks. Nice. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you?
I am doing well, Sam. How about you?
You seem to be handling the end of the Knicks streak quite well. I know you want to go into how who is it that they were playing?
They're playing the Suns, and you just like, I mean, they're one of the three best teams in the West. I know LeBron's still not back, so yeah, the Lakers will have their own day in the sun, pun not really intended, but Chris Paul is just like, there's not much you can do down the stretch when he's that clutch. It's unreal at this, you know, at this late in his career.
None of that made any sense to me. Had no idea. All I heard on the radio was the Knicks lost, and I knew you'd be you'd have a reaction to it. But I know all the other stuff, and I mean, I know the Phoenix Suns. I know they exist as a basketball team. But
he's in those State Farm commercials.
I'm not familiar with that either.
Okay.
All right. Let's get into this. We have a, I guess Fox News is feeling a little bit sensitive these days when it comes to retraction. I think there's still ongoing suit of like $1.6 billion following their insistence that there was, that Dominion, a voting machine company, had a secret server in Germany, and there were SWAT teams. I have no idea, but they seem to be a little sensitive because they have retracted the story that Joe Biden will be outlawing hamburgers on July 4th. Here is the first of the retractions. That's John Roberts at Fox News.
On Friday, we told you about a study from the University of Michigan to give some perspective on President Biden's ambitious climate change goals. That research from 2020 found that cutting back how much red meat people eat would have a drastic impact on harmful greenhouse gas emissions. The data was accurate, but a graphic and a script incorrectly implied that it was part of Biden's plan for dealing with climate change. That is not the case. One state now looking to...
Just blowing right by it.
You know, I mean, at least they put that out there. I didn't even realize that the study was done prior to Biden releasing his plan, at least as president. But I don't know. Maybe, you know, you hear it put that way by John Roberts that drastically cutting back on our meat consumption will help climate change. That might be a good idea. I don't know. Food for thought.
Right. Food sounds like meatless food for thought.
Meatless, right, food for thought. Now, of course, one of the things that I have vowed to do, and I have always done this, you know, I've cut back on my my meat consumption fairly dramatically over the years. But one thing that I have always done since I was in my early 20s is I have, whenever I had a beer, I always reached for a plant-based beer. That was it. I was just not gonna
typical hippie liberal.
That's right. I was a very I was super woke back before that was even a thing, back when I was in my 20s in college. Even only plant-based beer for me. Of course, I'm referring to Larry Kudlow, who now says, oh, when I said plant-based beer, I was joking, because you know the joke that's involved in that the joke is that Larry Kudlow has no idea what is coming out of his mouth here.
Wit. No, of course I know beer is plant-based. Some people can't take a joke. Some people responded with an even worse joke. Take Chuck Schumer, who tweeted last night, and I quote, excited to be watching the Oscars with an ice-cold plant-based beer. Thanks, Joe Biden. By the way, Schumer... didn't your mother tell you not to sit too close to the TV? You'll strain your eyes. And by the way, I didn't say Biden was in favor of only plant-based food. I was citing a Michigan survey. So get new glasses, Mr. Schumer. And folks, it's plant-based. It's
Yeah, no, what he was doing was citing a Daily Mail article that made the rounds to people like Lauren Boebert and other crackpots on the right, that conflated a random study with Biden's actual agenda and proposals, and his writers didn't do fact checks, and now he has to pretend he was joking. Well, the fact that he doesn't even really know what's in beer. And I have said before, Kudlow doesn't seem like a beer guy. He seems like a brown liquor, old school Mad Men type fella. So maybe he just really is that ignorant about what beer is.
Yeah, I get the sense that, I mean, Kudlow, I wouldn't guess necessarily brown liquor as much as I would guess, like, maybe, you know, mouthwash in the drawer type of guy. I don't know if you ran into any of those back in the day. That was the mouthwash.
That's pretty dark, Sam.
Yeah, well, I mean, Kudlow's trajectory, he was I think broken by the Trump administration. I mean, he was broken before, but then he was broken again by the Trump administration.
But I will say, I'm excited that you have already grown accustomed to plant-based beer, because you will adjust nicely under Biden's green dictatorship, obviously.
Yeah, that's going to be super easy for me to make that adjustment to the plant-based beer. But it's funny, too, that he doesn't feel like he needs to, you know, he's doubling down on it. And frankly, I thought that Schumer's joke was certainly better than Kudlow's joke. I mean, neither one of them was laugh out loud.
It's just so insular. I mean, I'm sorry. I tweeted, like, who is this for? It really is just for I'm annoyed that the Senate majority leader is kind of involving himself in this squabble, really, when I didn't even fully get it at first. And also when my annoyance with him grows every day as he's unable to get anywhere on filibuster reform and thus the agenda.
Yeah. You get rid of the filibuster, leave the Kudlow Duncan to us, please, sir.
Exactly.
Exactly. Or we may have to, I don't know, switch roles. Schumer wants to sit here, but that's a different story. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Michael Mechanic. He is the author of Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. Be right back in just a moment with that. And in the meantime, oh, this is fun. I don't know if you guys remember back, I don't know when it was, a year or two ago, a year ago, probably, Brendan James and I think we had Noah Culwin on. They came on the program for their new podcast, Blowback. And today's episode of Majority Report is brought to you by season two of the podcast, Blowback. It's exclusively available on Stitcher Premium. After a critically acclaimed retelling of the Iraq War, John Benjamin actually, I think, voiced Saddam Hussein on that, if I'm not mistaken. Season two of Blowback presents the unlikely story of the Cuban Revolution. America's Cold War crusade brings the world to a nuclear-tipped showdown between the Kennedy brothers, Fidel Castro, the Soviet Union, the CIA, and the Mafia. It's co-hosted, like I say, by Brendan James and Noah Culwin. Season two is a 10-part account of how the United States tried and failed to thwart the creation of a socialist government less than 100 miles to its south. Listen now and get a free month of Stitcher Premium. Go to stitcher.com/premium. At stitcher.com/premium. Enter the promo code MAJORITY when you select a monthly plan. That's stitcher.com/premium. Promo code MAJORITY. Check it out. Also, folks, you know how I am when it comes to expending money on areas where I don't have to. Well, you shouldn't have to choose between a great shave and a fair price. And with Harry's razors, you don't have to. For a limited time, Harry's is offering their starter set plus free travel size body wash at harrys.com/majority. I've been talking about Harry's for years. Harry's delivers a close, comfortable shave. And here's the kicker. It is less than $2 per refill. So you don't have to go out and mortgage the house to get all those sort of Buffy razors that they sell at the department stores or whatever it is, the big pharmacies. Harry's bought a German razor blade factory. They've been making blades for over 100 years in that factory. And then Harry's design team combined a weighted ergonomic handle with a textured grip and flex hinge. It is a smart, simple razor designed for delivering a close shave along all the contours of your face. They stand behind the quality of their blades so much, they have a 100% money-back guarantee on Harry's at harrys.com. Folks, I don't like to shave that often. I'm down to like once a week now. But when I do, it is Harry's always there for me. They have a trimmer blade head, which is good for my nasal challenges. I don't want to go too deep into that. No pun intended, but that has always been. And also, I just like the look of them. The razors look, they're a little refined. They show a little bit of, I don't want to say class, but, you know, they're refined. They're not as all buffed up. That's the thing. I hate those razors that make me feel like I'm, you know, I should have it on my utility belt or something. And all of their products, the body wash is excellent. For a limited time, Harry's has made their exclusive offer even better for listeners of the show. New customers can get a special offer in a Harry's starter set and body wash at harrys.com/majority. You get the 5-blade razor, the weighted Truman handle, foaming shave gel, and the travel blade cover and a travel size body wash. There has never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/majority to redeem your offer today. Check it out. And lastly, oh, this is a good idea. For Mother's Day, you got time, but you're down to like getting a something digital. And here it is. A Mother's Day gift that your mom will actually enjoy not just once, but monthly. It's called Hunt a Killer. Yeah, it's a murder mystery subscription box. And the thing is, you can play it with your mom. Or your mom can play it with her friends, play it with your dad. She can play it with her other kids if she likes them better than you. But what happens with Hunt a Killer is that you become a detective in a murder mystery. With each Hunt a Killer box, you sift through documents, you get evidence, you get audio recordings, you get case files, sometimes pictures, you eliminate suspects, you identify murder weapons, you crack the case, you catch the killer. It's like an escape room delivered right to your door. I mean, it's sort of like a much more sophisticated game of Clue, or it's like you're watching a murder mystery and you get to actually join in. And Hunt a Killer's got a spoiler-free community with thousands of members. You can go there and you can test theories, et cetera, et cetera. Part of proceeds of every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation. It's an organization dedicated to helping with real-life cold cases. Mile and I did that. What was that called again, Matt? The theater one. I can't remember the title of it now. I'm having but it was a case, a cold case from the was it the 20s or the 30s? Just somebody who was selling a theater found all this evidence about this case, and so it brought you back into time. They're not all timepieces necessarily, but this one was really fun. Hard, it's challenging, keeps you engaged, and for those of you who got kids, keeps them off of their screens for just about, you know, for even a couple hours a week is fantastic. It's great for Mother's Day. Like I say, it's a great way to keep in touch with your folks and your mom month in, month out. Right now, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority for 20% off your first box. Again, make sure to use the promo code majority for 20% discount. You'll be answering the question, do you have what it takes to hunt a killer? All right. Want to welcome to the program the senior editor at Mother Jones, author of Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. Michael Mechanic. Michael, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be here.
Let's just start. Like, how did you decide to engage in this project? It's a fascinating world in which these folks live in, but it's also, I don't know, sometimes I find it gross, frankly. But how did you decide to look into this, and what was the idea behind it?
Well, I had the initial idea like two decades ago. I was just sort of thinking the way we get obsessed with big lottery winners and sort of what happens to them, and the conventional wisdom is that their lives are ruined by it. Well, what really happens to them, and have we ever heard, you know, deeply from them about this? So I thought you'd write a book called Jackpot, and each chapter would kind of be the experience of a different person who had come into great wealth. And that was really impractical, because I didn't do it. It was backburned. It was one of those kinds of ideas. But it would have been impossible, because lottery winners, they go completely off the radar. They cut off all communications with the outside world, pretty much. They're not going to talk. There's no way you're going to get enough to fill a book, certainly. And so I kind of put it on the back burner. And then one day I'm at Mother Jones. A literary agent calls me up. He'd been reading my stuff and liked it. He said, "Have you ever thought about writing a book?" And I said, "Well, actually, yeah." And we talked about it, and we kind of fleshed out the idea to kind of look at wealth obtained in various types of ways, not just the pure luck, but the building a company and selling it, or making a prescient investment, or things like this. There's a lot of different flavors of coming into wealth. And it seemed really timely now, because we're at this moment of incredible, staggering wealth inequality in this country, and our system is set up to make that happen, essentially. So we decided it would be a good time to to investigate that phenomenon.
It's interesting. Do me one favor. Will you move your microphone away from your shirt there for a moment?
Sorry, yeah. Is it rubbing?
Yeah. We're getting it rubbing in there. And so let me ask you this about the people and we'll get into this because you talk about like the money is the concentration of this wealth. And we'll get into that part of the book is, has horrible impacts on society. In a myriad of ways, but it also hurts, or at least the people you're talking to, there's a lot of problems that they go through. Nobody makes the argument that it's better, that it's more fun to not have money necessarily, but the money, and I'm not convinced that necessarily a certain amount of money can't buy them happiness, but it does create certain psychological issues. But I wonder, do you think that also was skewed insofar as who would provide you access? In other words,
yes.
If I'm ambivalent about the amount of money I have and it's causing me problems and I want to tell somebody about it, you come along, I'm going to say yes. But if I'm one of those people who's like, I'd rather people not know exactly what I'm up to because I'm fine and I might not talk to you.
It's actually hard to know because there's people who have problems who wouldn't want to talk about it. And they say this is very private. And then there's people who have problems who are desperate to talk about it. But the fact is, it was hard to get people for this book because, you know, money being such a taboo subject in our society. I mean, we love talking about it, but we don't like to talk about our own personal financial situation. It's like talking about your sex life, actually worse, right? So I got a lot of rejections. I mean, every billionaire puts you through their PR team and the PR team says, what's the upside to us? And it's hard to give a good answer to that question. You know, it's more like a societal view. And they always just say, we think your book sounds great, but no thanks, we're not gonna do it.
But that is sort of almost like incumbent in amassing that kind of wealth, right? Which is, we're not so much in it for the societal view as much as we are in it for our amassing a fortune.
Yeah, but it also just sort of happens. You know, the way the system is set up, you're building company, you're amassing wealth, and the wealth amasses more wealth. And whether you think that's a good thing or not, it's just sort of the way it happens. And the fact is, you get into this wealth management world where you if you have so much money, it's really hard to manage it yourself unless you're a master investor, right? You have to hire people to kind of help you. You have this financial entourage, and their default is to minimize taxes and maximize returns for you. So unless you are on top of them to do, you know, social justice investing or equitable things, they're going to go that route, you know. And you're going to end up with ridiculous amounts of money. You know, in the wealth spectrum, there's people who go out of their way to sort of twist the system further to their advantage. And then there's people on the other end, like the patriotic millionaires who are actually lobbying for more equitable tax policies and things like that. But most of the people are just sort of doing their thing in the middle. You know, it's not, they're not necessarily bad people, but they have a lot of money and that money is growing and growing. And sometimes they express some guilt about it. But, you know, I had one guy say, you know, it's funny. I feel like I should be paying taxes and people should pay taxes. I believe in that. I think government has a big role. But then I go and I talk to my estate lawyer and we're talking about how do I shield the most money as possible. He said, it's this weird disconnect because when it comes to your own situation, all of a sudden, hey, that's my money.
Well, I feel like people in every walk of life, but as it pertains to what you wrote about in your book, choose to sanitize situations in order to, I guess, make themselves, I don't know, feel better or justify certain ways of living. Did you find that there was a whitewashing, I guess, of the ways in which this wealth was accumulated or the fact that wealthy people are often a part of a system that they may, you know, critique from the outside, but that they're very much still a part of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think we all want to think we're good people, right? Wealthy or poor. Everybody wants to think of themselves as a good person. And when you see that you're benefiting from a very unfair system, it can conflict with that self-image. So I think there's a lot of denial. Like you said, Sam, there was some sort of self-selection in the type of people who would actually talk to a journalist, let alone a Mother Jones reporter, right?
Right.
So I probably tended to get more liberally minded people than conservative, like recluses, right? But there's certainly, I mean, they'll talk about that disconnect too. The people, my subjects would talk about that disconnect. And there's a lot of people who won't. They're just in denial. You know, I spoke to a lot of people in the orbits of extremely wealthy people, and they say, I talk to these billionaires that the system is fair. I'm self-made. Everything is fine. And why are you talking about this racial stuff that happened so long ago? You know, there's just a denial of reality as far as the way the playing field is slanted toward the very wealthy in this country.
That part of your book, I think, is really important, particularly in the context. I mean, just yesterday we played a clip of Bill Gates, sort of casually talking about, well, look, I got this handled. I'm talking to the CEOs of the vaccination companies more and more you see the impact that Bill Gates' money and supposed, I want to get into the philanthropy, because I think that's sort of the most interesting part of what you, but the psychology of these people is really important for people to understand, because guys like Bill Gates are considered, like, they're so benevolent, and the giving pledge that we're going to give the money away, largely it's irrelevant. Their largesse, because the idea that they get to control these type of resources is very dangerous. And the idea that you are surrounded and untethered from the reality of, I mean, these people, it seems to me, operate like gods. I mean, the rules simply do not apply. Can you go through some of the stuff of, like, you know, and I just, I had a buddy who I hadn't been in touch with for a while, and he had told me that he became, that he was working in the inner circle, not on the personal side, but on the business side, of a billionaire. And he said, I know you think it's bad. It's worse. and he talked about, like, there is no such thing as customs for billionaires. They land in the airport and they just walk through. They don't go through passport control. None of that applies. Like, they just operate on a different plane. They're mad about something at the University of Pennsylvania. They pick up the phone and call the president in the way that you would, you know, with less hesitation than you would to call the cable company and tell them that your service is bad. Talk a little bit about that element of their lives.
Yeah, the access thing is huge. Access to anyone you want, people, politicians, celebrities, you know, and I think it has to get to your head after a while, right? The fact that you can just call your senator and they'll call you back, or you call the agent of some Hollywood celebrity, hey, can you come play at my party, hang out at my party? Sure, yeah. And one of the guys I was talking to, this is one of the most stupefying things of coming into the kind of money that I have, is everybody will call me back, you know, and that also you start giving money, you get in with the leaders of these organizations, and all of a sudden you're having dinner with the head of Conservation International, or you're having dinner with, you know, diplomats, and, you know, and Stanley McChrystal is coming to your neighbor's house to give a book reading. You invite it over there. You're invited to fundraisers, gives you direct access to political candidates. And all these things, I mean, psychologically, it makes you think, I can have anything I want. Because you can. And not only that, but the political attitudes of very wealthy people are different than the attitudes of the public. What they want is different than what the public wants. on things like environment, for one. That was a big one. For redistributive policies, the wealthy folks are not too happy about the wealth tax that Elizabeth Warren is proposing, or, you know, Biden's recent
capital gains.
Yeah. In fact, Biden announced this morning or yesterday, he wants $80 billion to beef up IRS enforcement on high earners, which have been, that's a little snippet in my book that's kind of interesting. It's 2010, it was like 23% of earners over $10 million were audited. And now it's like 0.3%. The IRS has been gutted, and it's almost like you can get away with anything.
And how aware, I mean, obviously the accountants that a billionaire, let's say, or 100 millionaire hires, they're all aware of this. And so that changes their behavior, right? Like 10 years ago, I wouldn't have taken this deduction or whatever it is, or I wouldn't have created this financial vehicle because there's a 1 in 5 chance that we're going to get audited. The chance is so low now that the risk reward calculation, I'm going to do it. If we end up having to pay a fine here, we pay a fine. I mean, all of this is operating. How much awareness is there between that team and the billionaire? Or is it just the, you know, do you lose count of your money at that point?
I think so. On the other hand, you know, the billionaires are mostly business people. Some of them are inheritors, but many of them are people who have built companies. So they can be a little bit micromanaging. You know, they want to know what's going on with their finances. But yeah, the tricks that they're pulling, even if they get challenged by the IRS, there's like this special tax court that none of us have ever heard of. And they send their lawyers to this tax court, and they usually can work out a deal, even if what they're doing is really quite fraudulent. And there's some cases of hedge funders and Wall Street banks recently doing something called basket options, which I didn't put in the book, but it's a total fraud. It's a tax scam, and they've been working on a settlement with the IRS, but you know, this is like tens of billions of dollars in extra profits these guys got. And, you know, they're going to get their wrists slapped probably. Or maybe they'll have to pay some penalties, but it's these guys are so rich, it doesn't even matter to them.
Right.
Can you talk about this concept of wealth segregation and how that exacerbates a lot of the dynamics that you researched in your book?
Yeah, sure. So economists call it income segregation, because it's really hard to measure people's wealth. We don't know what people have. We can tell by tax records what their income is. And so in a metropolitan area, especially where there's high income inequality, I call it wealth flight. Like the wealthy will concentrate in pockets and leaving the poor in pockets. And then you get these mixed income areas in the center where they're smaller and smaller, fewer and fewer people living in them. So you have the affluent over here, you have the less affluent over here, and you have the people in the middle. And what that does is it creates these bubbles where, you know, you might hear your friend Bob is talking about his private jet that he just bought, or his yacht and his house in Aspen. And that's all normal, right? Most of us go to a party and, you know, people are talking about their paying their mortgage or their landlord threatening to evict them. But these guys, you know, they live in this world where the concierge medicine and, you know, and whatever, the elite private school, this is just, you know, and what happens is when you live in that sort of element and you don't sort of see how other people struggle, there's a loss of empathy. And there's also distrust from both ends. Oh, these rich people are jerks. They're, you know, they're arrogant. They're clueless. And then the rich people are saying, who are those people over there? I don't know what they're up to. Maybe they're going to come and burn my house down. So you get this sort of tearing of social fabric. And I think that tearing of social fabric is evident in some of the problems, social problems we see now, sort of the deterioration of civil society that we've seen in the past several years.
It reminds me of the complaint about the idea of a free college option. like that it would be horrible if a millionaire, a billionaire's kid went to a free public college with everyone else, like as if that would be not, I mean, I would pay extra for that happening in society.
Yeah,
it would be great. Healthy. But I want to just like focus on this before we move on to sort of like a couple other things, is this, this notion of being cloistered there and what it does in terms of the empathy. A longtime listener of this program told a story about Robert Rubin in a car. She had gone to some a fundraiser, and he happened to be sitting next to her and was complaining about his car ride to the place in a town car. He apparently got on the phone and called the mayor's office, got the you know, complaining about the traffic. And she asked him, "Where were you?" And he goes, I don't know. I mean, he's in Manhattan, has no idea. He's complaining about the traffic, but he's not, he is not even where he is. Like, they're living on a totally different plane here. And you talk about this sort of being cloistered. There is this concept of acquired narcissism, which, you know, and I have no experience with people of this kind of wealth, but I do have this experience with people who are, you know, famous, who have achieved this level of fame, and you are in all of a sudden a bubble. And the ability to assess like what people just go through in their daily basis is just, it's just gone. And that has to inform everything you do in terms of your politics, right? I mean, were there people that you spoke to who you felt like thought they were really in touch, but completely oblivious?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was the one guy I talked to is a private equity guy who goes and he gets, what do you call it? Carried interest, right? Carried interest is for guys like that, for guys like Donald Trump, partnerships that do investments. It's a huge boon, hedge fund managers. And so this loophole just seems to last and last and last, and nobody's been able to kill it yet. Trump was talking about killing it when he was on the campaign trail. Hillary Clinton was talking about killing it. Of course, Trump wasn't going to kill it because he benefits from it, as do a lot of his pals. So this guy said, I personally go with this group to Washington every year to lobby in favor of this. And he says, we tell him, oh, you know, it's great for California. And then he says, BS. So he admitted it. He admitted that like it is BS. But, you know, he also said, I think he thinks the economic system is fair. And I don't know.
He thinks that because he's done well by it. Right, exactly. How does it impact? I mean, you go into the sort of gender and race issues. I mean, what were the most salient points that you came across there? Obviously, you know, we don't have an enormous amount of black wealth in this country. There's not the communities of like billionaires that there are in terms of white people. Also true, I guess, with women as well. What implications of that at that level?
Yeah, we only have 7 black billionaires. We should have something like 100. I can't recall the calculation, but
and you, it, you say we all, should have.
That's, well, I mean, by population,
right? And I mean, there's Homestead Act. I mean, there's a whole litany of things that we have done in this country to prevent black people from gaining wealth.
And women, for that matter, because if you look at the global ultra wealthy people with 30 million and up, it's 9 men to every woman. Wow. And this is something I learned that I hadn't known. Until 1974, a woman could not get a bank loan without a man's signature on it. So if you were divorced, if you were widowed, if you were single, you couldn't get a loan to start a business. And actually, access to capital throughout all these things, we say this is race discrimination, this is gender discrimination. It's all economic at its core. And it's because it's preventing people from getting money, from accumulating money. And with black people in America, it's something that one of my sources referred to as the black tax, which started with slavery, which was the 100% black tax, all economic opportunities taken from you. And then after that, you talked about the Homestead Act. The Homestead Act started at the end of the Civil War. It's the biggest public to private land transfer, or actually wealth transfer, because land was the wealth then, in American history. And they gave away 160-acre parcels to anyone who would go and improve on them. But Black people, they, you know, the law didn't say Black people could do this. But in reality, the way it was structured in the time and the difficulty of Black people in getting around and access to the process, it was something like 1.4 million white families and only 5,000 Black families got land. And that land was the basis of intergenerational wealth. That's what you left to your children. So that was a huge thing. You have all these things throughout our history where the federal government has boosted white wealth and left Black folks on the side. You know, the housing stuff that we all know about, all the
right.
federal backing of housing loans. You couldn't get a home loan until, you know, the late 60s or 70s if you were Black. You were kept out of communities because there were racial covenants. And the white communities were built up at taxpayer expense. The Black communities were ignored. And you get some of the same capital issues even now, both, you know, if you're Black or you're a woman trying to get, you know, venture capital funding or trying to get a bank to give you money to start a company, it's much higher bar.
Right. And of course, all of this is not to say that there should be more Black billionaires. There should just be less billionaires, if any, as far as I'm concerned, none should not exist. At one point, I sat on a panel with, his name escapes me at the moment, but he was a big, I think he owned BET, and he's one of the...
Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
Robert Johnson?
No, maybe it wasn't then. It wasn't, maybe he didn't own BET. Maybe it was a different guy. It wasn't Robert Johnson. I can't remember his name. But I sat on a panel with him, and he's saying that the Congressional Black Caucus wanted to get rid of the estate tax or something to that effect. And the idea was to build, you know, Black intergenerational wealth. And I was like, well, wait a second. That's maybe we shouldn't do it that way, because that's just going to benefit you. I can't remember exactly what who he was. Peebles or something to that effect. He was a
that sounds familiar.
And but nevertheless, so let's move to this question of philanthropy, because we've talked about philanthropy on this program in many ways. But how do these wealthy people perceive of their charitable givings, and why? Let's get into the part of where it harms the you know, all of us. I mean, obviously, the fact that they have more access to politicians. Highly problematic. You cite the Gillen's research on whenever there's any type of controversial issue, it is the wealthy people who have Congress decides in favor of. How else does it hurt us?
Well, when you have essentially taxpayers subsidize philanthropic giving. Now, if you accumulate money, especially if you accumulate it in questionable ways, you know, you underpay your workers, you fight against policies that would help the middle class and try to enrich yourself, and you amass all this money, and then you give back as some sort of grand sort of salve for some of the problems that you helped to create, it's sort of reputation burnishing. And the trouble is not philanthropy per se, because philanthropy is desirable. There's always going to be gaps that the government can't fill in that private interests can fill in. However, the degree to which philanthropy is presenting itself as a solution to society's problems, I mean, it gives these incredibly wealthy people incredible power over decisions that affect all of us, and no accountability, no ability to elect someone to make decisions for us. It's just, this guy wants to do this. He has the money. He's going to do it. When Rockefeller went before Congress, the John D. Rockefeller, he was trying to set up the first large general purpose foundation. He had to get a bill from Congress to charter it. He was ridiculed. Everyone said, are you kidding me? Like, this is just a power grab. You just want to have all this. So he went back to New York State and got it done in New York State. And, you know, and Congress had a chance to actually put some accountability on foundations, and they blew it. And now foundations have very little accountability. They only have to pay out 5% of their total assets every year. That's one of the few requirements of a foundation. But look at the way the stock market is growing. These guys have endowments. They're growing 20, 30, 40% in a year. In fact, the billionaire wealth just from the pandemic, it's gone up $1.6 trillion, 55% since the beginning of the pandemic. So the people on the giving pledge, people who signed the giving pledge, they're much richer than when they signed that thing.
Right. Well, let me ask you this about the foundations. I mean, because I mean, to me, these things function, it seems to me, as private governments, completely undemocratic governments, because they have the ability. And you know, I've been harping on it for quite some time. You know, Bill Gates completely altered the trajectory of education in this country to the worse. I mean, by their own assessment. When the Rand Corporation assessed the Gates Foundation and all the Gates work in education 2 or 3 years ago, they wrote, yeah, no, we were wrong. We shouldn't have done any of this stuff. And that's high stakes testing. That's value added measure of teachers. It is privatization measures. And by all accounts, they're doing the same thing with vaccinations. Today, we see that COVAX, which was wholly a Bill Gates sort of driven initiative, is missing the mark. They're going to fail to provide the vaccinations, the meager 20% of the they were supposed to provide vaccination for the 20% most poor in the world. They're not going to miss that. And all they've managed to do is to basically prevent the ability of other countries to produce these vaccines. That's to me where like the worst part about this. I mean, it's yes, they're escaping taxation, but on these foundations, the idea that they build their endowments, do they, and they only have to pay out 5%, the money that they build in their endowments, does that actually, like, does that become a deduction for the owners of these foundations? I mean, so, I mean, if they do, if they raise $300 million in the, you know, in the stock market with their endowment, let's just say, and then they deploy that $300 million. We're going to spend $100 million on malaria nets. Do they get credit? Do they deduct that on their own taxes in some fashion? Or is this maybe just a far too simplistic notion?
Well, they don't pay taxes. Oh, you, right. You mean the person who started the fund? No.
But yeah, the people who started the fund.
The charities and the foundations are all tax exempt. So
right.
They take a big deduction when they put money into the foundation in the first place. And then the foundation, that money grows with no capital gains. So, and the fact that they're paying out 5%, I mean, because when people make charitable donations, the taxpayers subsidize that because there's a charitable deduction. So we, you know, we're paying like a fifth or more of the cost of this. And then they sit on the money. Well, it's like we're sitting on all this dry powder that is tax subsidized. And so this is actually our money that is bound up at someone else's whim, and they can spend it as they like. I mean, I use the example, a simple example in the book is if you don't itemize your deductions, you can't take a charitable deduction. If you take the standard deduction, in other words, on your taxes, you can't take a charitable deduction. So if I take the standard deduction, I make a $1,000 donation to Feeding America, I pay $1,000. If Bill Gates does the same thing, you know, if his tax rate, effective tax rate is 25%, then he only pays $750. So the taxpayers are I'm subsidizing Bill Gates' giving. And, you know, I think it's fine that Bill Gates gives away a lot of money, but I don't need to be subsidizing that, nor do you, nor do lower income people.
I'm not even sure I like the idea that he's giving away a lot of money because, I mean, I am more happy with the U.S. government saying, guess what we're going to do? We're going to take away, you know, your wealth above X amount of dollars. I don't know what it is at this point, but because when he deploys his money, it is so large that it's political power. Right. And it is not just political. I mean, it is societal power. It is a power that we can't even, you know, he has the ability to make sure that there was no open source vaccine. I mean, that is not, I'm not, you know, I'm subsidizing his ability to do that. That's almost the least of the problem that we have as a world because of that. It's inhibiting. He has not been elected to anything. He is not even representative of a country that has elected people to anything. He has just made a unilateral decision based upon how much money he has that there's not going to be open source vaccine. Period. End of story. He has the resources in which to make that happen in the same way that a country would, but more so in many respects, because he doesn't have the constraints of any type of accountability for this.
Yeah. Well, remember when I talked about Rockefeller getting a bad reception from Congress, you know, members of Congress and former President Teddy Roosevelt was saying just what you're saying right now, but now we don't think that way anymore in this country. And I actually asked that question to Rob Reich, who wrote a book called Just Giving, where I learned a lot of these things. And he said, well, you know, we have this marketplace mentality, this sort of neoliberalism. We've started to conflate, you know, market performance with like goodness. And we revere our, you know, our captains of industry, and we look up to these people. And but just the mentality has changed in this country since then. We forget how undemocratic big philanthropy is, or we just, you know, maybe generations have passed and we've forgotten. But it's truly, it's always been undemocratic, and it could be reformed so it's not. But the way it's set up in this country, it sure is.
What would that look like, where we would have more public control of these foundations?
You could put conditions on foundations. You could force them to pay down their entire endowment over 50 years. You could there was a drive to increase it during the COVID, you know, to 10 or 15% payout. And then donor advised funds, you don't have to pay out anything. So billionaires will just park their money in donor advised funds. And it's great you set aside money for future giving, but they're doing it as a tax deduction. And then it's literally just sitting in this fund growing with nobody telling them to do anything with it. They can just have it sitting there. And these are things that Congress could change. Congress could change the charitable deduction, make it a tax credit, limit it to, you know, $5,000 or whatever. You don't have to reward this kind of philanthropy.
We could also say that for every dollar you make over, I don't know, 3 million, 90% of it goes to the U.S. government, like essentially like it did. This is what the tax rate was in the 50s, in the 60s, right? I mean, it was at that point, it was like $450,000. If you made more than that in a year, your tax rate was 90%. That's, I think, 3 million is pretty close to what 400,000 was. I mean, there's a precedent in this country. I mean, it's conceptually it works. I don't know that we have the politics to get that to happen in this country, but as a policy, if we're going to throw around policies, that to me seems like the best option.
Yeah. Well, it's not either or, you know, people can still give even if they're being taxed highly. I think, you know, one thing you hear from wealthy people all the time is, well, the government is not very good at they make lousy charity, right? So, well, the government isn't a charity. That's not what the government does. It's not supposed to do. I mean, it's a false comparison.
I would also argue that every human endeavor is a similar failure rate to governments. I mean, This is also part of it too. You have this COVAX that has unequivocally failed. It has unequivocally failed in meeting the goal of 20% vaccination for the poor in the world. You see what's happening in India. It has unequivocally failed, but yet that's not the headline. There is no talk about that. There is no accountability. And you know, if we were to judge, it's easy to judge the government, like, you know, go to the DMV. Well, the DMV actually does quite well. I've been to the DMV, fairly often, and I'm just as pleased with that as I am with the cable company or, I don't know, ending the, you know, the subscription. I mean, the, you know, from something I signed up for months ago. I mean, that is, it seems to me too, is part of that problem. And
well, Sam, you believe in government, right? But the Republican Party has been attacking the idea of government for decades, and it rubs off on a lot of people. Not only that, if I don't know if you read Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk. It's a great book about kind of what the government really does that you've never heard of. And he's a fabulous writer. But one thing that sort of stood out to me is like, there's actually a lot of government agencies that are not allowed by statute. And this is because, you know, Congress, some members of Congress have made this happen. They're not allowed to sort of toot their own horn and say, here's what we do, and put out some public, you know, positive public relations about it. Whereas the billionaire who does whatever has a PR team promoting it to all the media and so forth. So government is easy to hate, and it doesn't have much of a capacity to defend itself.
Well, it's a fascinating exploration into the minds, at least, of those who are willing to talk to you about this. And I think it's something that we need as a society, more awareness. Michael Mechanic, the book is Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, let's play a clip. It's just been announced that, we'll play this clip, but there's an announcement about masks that we have that seems to be coming from the CDC. We'll be right back. So the project, we've moved beyond denialism, right? With Fox when it comes to COVID, we're on now to resent of those who have taken COVID seriously. Really, is what it is. It is because the conservative mind does not work. None of their ideas work unless there is a significant amount of aggrievement, right? That is the foundational aspect of conservatism. If you hear someone, like, you cannot have a conservative argument unless it's about some aggrievement that is being expressed. Here is Tucker Carlson, the multimillionaire, I don't know, billionaire, I don't know about Swanson Foods, heir with multiple homes, who moved up to the furthest reaches of Maine during COVID. So it was real for him. Here he is now suggesting that you should literally SWAT people, call the police on people who are wearing masks.
As we did give in, this grotesque version of Halloween went on for more than a year, and it's still going on. Not even Tony Fauci still pretends that masks are medically necessary. Instead, masks are purely a sign of political obedience, like Kim Il-sung pins in Pyongyang. We wear them because we have to. The only people who wear masks voluntarily outside are zealots and neurotics. How neurotic are they? Well, we know. A Pew survey from last March found that 64% of white Americans who classify themselves as liberal or very liberal have been diagnosed with an actual mental health condition. And you see them everywhere when you walk down the street in any major city. If you dare to go on foot from Union Station to the Capitol, for example, in Washington without wearing a mask, angry Biden voters will snort at you in judgment. How could you? They're saying from behind the gauze. How could you? That's the question we should be asking of them in return. The rest of us should be snorting at them first. They're the aggressors. It's our job to brush them back and restore the society we were born in. So the next time you see someone in a mask on the sidewalk or on the bike path, do not hesitate. Ask politely but firmly, would you please take off your mask? Science shows there is no reason for you to be wearing it. Your mask is making me uncomfortable. We should do that, and we should keep doing it until wearing a mask outside is roughly as socially accepted as lighting a Marlboro in an elevator. It's repulsive. Don't do it around other people. That's the message we should send because it's true. As for forcing children to wear masks outside, that should be illegal. Your response when you see children wearing masks as they play should be no different from your response to seeing someone beat a kid in Walmart. Call the police immediately. Contact Child Protective Services. Keep calling until someone arrives. What you're looking at is abuse. It's child abuse, and you are morally obligated to attempt to prevent it. If it's your own children being abused, then act accordingly. Let's say your kid's school emailed you to announce that every day after lunch, your sixth grader was going to get punched in the face by a teacher. How would you respond to that? That's precisely how you should respond when they tell you that your kids have to wear masks on the soccer field. That is unacceptable, it is dangerous, and we should act like it, because it is.
So there's so much going on there. He conflates outdoor mask wearing with indoor mask wearing throughout the video. He compares a child wearing a mask to getting punched in the face by a teacher. And I am flummoxed as to his commitment to personal freedom there. If someone desires to wear a mask, is he basically canceling them by calling the cops and infringing upon their personal freedom? And then, of course, just the it's basically a badge, like they, to a Kim Il-sung badge or whatever he was trying to say there. And then goes after, he calls him Tony Fauci, the way he tries to go after Sandy Cortez. It's a way of belittling the science, et cetera. I mean, it's a greatest hits there by Tucker.
The amazing thing is look, and it's announced, I think as of today, the CDC is relaxing their guidelines on outdoor mask wearing. If you're vaccinated, and then of course, you know, the non-vaccinated are going to take their masks off as soon as they see other people not wearing masks, which is exactly the point. And, you know, we had on this program, Mark Alain Derry, and he maybe had him on 2 or 3 months ago. And he said, I had basically cut down, and he's an epidemiologist. He said, I had basically outdoors had more or less, you know, stop wearing masks around, you know, at gatherings and this and that. He started up again when there were new strains that were a little bit more contagious. The fact is that they have probably known for a couple of months at least that outdoor mask wearing is at least, you know, if you're distanced from people, is really not necessary. However, the point is, this is not about specific individuals. This is about how do you deal with a pandemic, which is a public health issue. If you want to know what is the efficacy, what is the value of wearing masks outdoors, where it is, it may be unnecessary in terms of stopping transmission outdoors, all you need to do is listen to Tucker Carlson rant and rave about it, because his aggrievement that other people are doing this is exhibit A, that you can have an impact on people's behavior by signaling things. And the impact that medical experts want is that people take this seriously and wear the masks indoors. There is absolutely no, and there was a new study out today that showed that wearing masks indoors inhibits, doesn't totally eliminate, but inhibits the transmission of this virus. They understand now, which they did not understand as well 6 months ago, and 12 months ago, they had no idea that the virus is aerosolized. Not so much, you know, a function of the spit and the droppings that come out when you speak about, in, but it's aerosolized and it is inhibited by wearing a mask. The 6 feet, 3 feet thing they're going to ultimately find is not as much of an issue because it is aerosolized. Even the screen that the plastic screen that we have in the office, largely irrelevant, except for the fact that we have multiple filters in the office that was sucking the air and it was creating a direction of an airflow. This is all, information that has been developed over time and people come to understand it. But the fact is that during a pandemic, the cost of being of erring on the side of less caution versus more caution is dramatic. But we will have more to say about that at other times. We're out of time for today, folks. We will see you again tomorrow. For those of you sticking around, again, I just want to make this point clear that the idea of erring on the side of more caution during a pandemic should be just obvious to everybody. And the fact that these lunatics are now having to move into this sort of notion of like, this isn't about, this is not analogous to the security theater that we have in going on planes, where we get searched to stop terrorists. This is about how do you get massive populations to behave in a way that is ultimately going to save lives during a state of semi-emergency, which is what a pandemic is. This isn't like, if we were going to live with the pandemic, with COVID at the way it was a year ago for 25 years, and someone could tell you that, it'll slowly diminish. Of course, the response would have been different. But, one of the things, the reason why we lost the pandemic, David Wallace Wells has a great article on this, is because the West didn't take it seriously early enough. And I remember the days at the end of February and early March thinking like, should I be wearing a mask? And I didn't wear a mask until I saw somebody else wear a mask on the street or two people. I mean, that is just, particularly in the West, we're just not comfortable wearing masks because we don't. In the Pacific, in Asian countries, mask wearing became far more socially acceptable. And that's how they were able to ramp up so quickly and prevent problems early on with COVID. It's because their population knew how to react to it. And here we have the absolute opposite. It's stunning to me that this guy, and he doesn't follow any of the stuff that he's saying. Yeah, he lives his life in a radically different way than any of the people who are watching him. And he knows it. And he is just so, he's so decrepit inside. It really is just stunning to me. And we're going to end up, police departments, schools, someone's go around and catalog all the calls that were being made because of what he just did. What a despicable human being. The harassment that he deserves is orders of magnitude beyond what the harassment that teachers are going to get in schools.
He said kids wearing a mask is the same as a teacher beating or hitting the child, or if you see a child being beaten at Walmart.
It's nuts. It's nuts.
This all is right. All about stoking that resentment.
Absolutely. It's a grievement. It's a grievement. All right. We got to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show free of commercials. Plus, now, also, you can pick up the app at majorityapp.com. We're going to try and integrate that in with our Discord. You can go to majoritydiscord.com to join the conversation. We have almost 2,000 members of the Discord in just a matter of days. So check it out. Join the Discord. Get part of the conversation. Also, AM Quickie, sign up for that. All of your memberships support all of these different things. The app, the AM Quickie, the Discord, all of it is supported by our members. And all of those things are free. for the user. And so check it out. Thank you to our members. Let's have Nomi on. Tell us who's going to be on the Nomi Key show today. She here?
Joining us now.
There's a picture of
her. I'll just quickly plug Left Reckoning. We'll have Ben Burgess on this week to talk about his new book, Canceling Comedians, about cancel culture debates and how and his sort of foray into it's going to be a little bit controversial. So Thursday, 8
Eastern. We got to have him on for that.
Yeah, Thursday, 8 Eastern. You'd love to. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get the post game.
Fantastic. Where's Nomi? Nomi, you there?
I'm coming. It's happening.
There
Hi.
She is.
Hi. God, give me a second, guys. I got to get all of my settings right.
Nomi, who's going to be on the Nomi Key show today?
Oh, yes. So we have a great show today. We have Stephen Donziger, who is an attorney who has been...
Oh, for Chevron.
Yes. Crazy story.
Oh, yeah. I've been wanting to get that guy on.
We'll connect you.
Yes, do. Folks, okay. You should check this out. Tell everybody this story. This is unbelievable.
Well, he's going to tell a story, but he's been... there's been an incredible activist community rising up for him, but this is a lawyer who's been taking on Chevron and has been prosecuted, I guess, is for basically challenging Chevron legally. That's, I don't know, not the best explanation, but he will explain it, his entire story. It's a crazy, it really is crazy. It's been going on for a while. But finally they're picking up speed, and he is available to do interviews, which really makes a huge difference. So that's at 3 o'clock Eastern on youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow, twitch.com/Twitch_NomiKey_show. I'm multitasking. I'm trying to set things up. You're asking me very detailed things, and I'm trying to make sure my microphone's working. Because what happens, just for folks to know, I'll be sitting in the green, I'm like setting things up, and then suddenly it just goes live. And I'm like, is everything ready? There's nobody in my ear saying countdown, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, live.
Yeah, no, we don't have any of those backroom stuff. That, imagine being a guest and coming on for the first time. You have no idea what's happening.
This is punk rock daily news.
It is.
Exactly.
Which makes it so, much punk. Better. Because you know... You know Keith Olbermann can't do this.
No, he can't.
I mean, didn't his like thing went down? Didn't his entire show go down like during COVID?
I don't know. You mean like physically?
The entire the feed like went down. And they were like panicking. They didn't know what to do. I was like, oh, that's just every day on our shows.
What?
And know what to do.
That happened.
Yeah, roll with it.
I don't. I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, pull it off. All right, let's go to the fun half. Just a reminder, hit the like button, subscribe. Also, Poggers tells me MIDI doctors. All right, see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.